This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he is every show, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, you're looking a little bit weary today, maybe as if you've been running away from something for the last 3 months.
Well, Chris, it's just all the podcasting. It's just, you know, there's so much podcasting to be done, and just not enough time to get it all in, and the editing and everything. Oh, the podcasting, Chris, the podcasting. No, actually, I'm doing well. How are you, Chris?
People are like, we got to do something to help out Matthew. He's going to quit the order. No, of course, I'm referring to the opening scene of the episode we're going to talk about today, A Time to Stand, the season premiere of Season 6 of Deep Space Nine, and it's actually the second part of our look at the Dominion invasion, or as many call it, the occupation arc, that began with A Call to Arms at the end of Season 5. And in this episode, the first thing we see is the battle fleet, the Federation fleet that we saw the Defiant and Martok ship join with at the end of Season 5. But things aren't going very well for them. They have been on the run for 3 months. There's a lot of damage to the ships in the fleet, and generally speaking, our characters are very, very tired.
Chris, you know, it was funny watching this episode today, and obviously I've seen this one quite a few times just because it's such a great arc to sit down and rewatch, especially if you can sit down and rewatch, you know, a few at a time. Yeah. And I was really struck by just how tired everybody was. You know, you see this ragtag Federation fleet. You know, you have all these, honestly, kitbash ships that have all been put together by the modeling team, you know, that look...
I know, there are a lot of, like, Maquis fighters and things showing up in there.
They look terrible in the first place, but then, of course, they're also heavily battle damaged, and, you know, you've got other ships towing other ships with tractor beams and stuff, and then, of course, you get onto the Defiant, and, you know, our characters are either haggard in just their face, or, you know, like Bashir, he's got his jacket open, he's got, you know, his turtleneck kind of
that's when you know things are serious.
Yeah, when you unzip the turtleneck, you know it's bad. So
yeah,
and just the general mood of everyone, it is horrible. And so to open the season like this, I mean, the season ender, losing the station, very unexpected, but I think this is even more unexpected to come back and just feel like our heroes have really gotten their butts kicked all up and down the quadrant, apparently, and it's just not been going well for them.
Well, you'll remember from our first part of this discussion that at the end of A Call to Arms, when the Defiant and Martok ship rejoin the fleet, the intention of the writers was not for them to turn around and join the fleet, which is heading back towards the station. And that created an implication and maybe a fan expectation that the fleet was on its way to retake the station, and that was not the plan of the story. And that's why they open this episode with the fleet heavily damaged and things not going very well for them. So they did an effective job, I think, of shattering that expectation that we all had over the summer that season 6 was going to open with some grand mission to get Deep Space Nine back in what would be a normal storytelling style for Star Trek, that in the next episode we're going to fix what went wrong in the previous one and everything's going to be happy again for the crew on the station.
Yeah, and I think that was, I remember watching it in real time, you know, when we were watching the show, and because right. it was still on, and you came back to this season. I think we all did expect this to kind of end quickly, because that's how you do things on Star Trek. You know, we're used to the best of both worlds. You come back next year and you fix it. And here they do this really unexpected thing, and the whole episode is kind of full of them that we are not going to fix this right away. In fact, you get the feeling from this episode, oh God, are they not going to fix this the whole season? I mean, will we ever get back to the station this season?
Well, you know it's not going to be anytime soon, because the episode ends with them 17 years away from the nearest right. Federation.
Exactly. You feel like, whoa, did this just turn into Voyager all of a sudden?
Without warp drive.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It really is, I think, an effective way to tell the story that they're trying to tell, which is this basically Band of Brothers war epic type thing that's going to be going on with these characters, and really stretching what it means to be in the 24th century with all of these ideals and put them to a test. I can't say enough for what I think that this arc is going to do for the characters and everything, and the series. You know, I think people think of Deep Space Nine as the Dominion War series, and yet it doesn't really start officially until the end of season 5.
Right.
And so you've just been kind of building it and layering it in throughout the season. So it was a shocking thing, because again, when have we ever seen this? We'd never seen this on TNG. That had never happened.
Nothing drawn out like that.
So
they don't lose the Enterprise, right? And they have to find their way back to the Enterprise and retake it over the course of 6 episodes.
Well, you don't lose the Enterprise until you put Deanna in charge of driving. And then
you lose the Enterprise.
I mean, seriously, it's gone. It's never coming back.
Getting it back. Well, also building on a call to arms at the end of season 5 is the minefield. And that really takes center stage early on. And it's interesting how much time has passed and they still haven't been able to take it down. We find out that Dukat has been promising Wayoon for 2 months that they would take the minefield down. And you would think that someone with technology like the Cardassians or the Dominion, given 2 months, would figure out a way to prevent a mine from replicating itself. But yet Dukat says every time we disable one, its neighbor replicates a new one. Was that surprising to you, that and was it believable, I guess, as well as a story element?
The fact that the mines, that they're having so much trouble with them?
That they're having so much trouble. I mean, obviously, the fact that the mine can replicate itself, that's fine. That's explained when O'Brien's putting it together. But the fact that 2 months later, they've basically made no progress in removing this minefield.
I think it goes to speak with just how diabolical the plan was that Rom had come up with, how difficult it would be to, you know, take on these mines, because obviously you can't just take it on one mine at a time, because it just replicates a new one before, you know, and so or the one next to it will replicate a mine. So it
right.
the plan that they come up with later on was to take them all down at one time. And yeah, I can understand there being such a frustration of, also when you're trying to defuse something like this, usually you want to be able to capture it, or isolate one, but you can't do that either because it just keeps, you know, so it really does seem like a conundrum of, okay, how do we take this down?
You know, this minefield, they are the tribbles of war.
Yeah, they really are. They just keep breeding like rabbits or tribbles.
Exactly. You know, going back to something else we talked about in the first part of our series here, do you think Dekkad is really kicking himself now for not going and taking care of the Defiant before taking the station?
Oh, goodness. Yes. Well, and you know, that's something that we talked about. If Dekkad had just gone for the minefield and the Defiant first time, you know, before they even take the station, this wouldn't have been a problem. And what's interesting is that doesn't even seem to be a thought in anybody's head that they could have stopped this.
Right. Yeah.
So that's what I think is so interesting, is that you would think that somebody would have thought, maybe if we had just taken out the Defiant before they had finished the minefield, we might have had better luck with the minefield.
It feels like something that Damar would say to Dekkad. And maybe later he would. I mean, at this point, you get the feeling that Damar he's like the good soldier under Dekkad, and he just agrees with Dekkad and does what Dekkad wants him to do. Whereas as we progress through the season, I think he would be more likely to speak up. But I can just hear it in my head. I can hear Damar saying, you should have taken out the Defiant in the first place.
Yeah, well, and the other thought is, I think Dekkad might be crazy enough at this point to where people don't come and tell him he's doing the wrong thing except Weyoun. You know, nobody's going to cross Dekkad because he has all the power he can have at this point. And the only person who can kind of curtail that power at all is Weyoun. And so who's going to tell him that he made a mistake? No one, you know, and
Kira would.
Well, yes. but I don't think Kira wants to upset Dekkad in that way right now.
Right.
Especially when she's fearful for the Bajoran people. So.
Right. Maybe she could tell him over a nice dinner. I think he'd really enjoy that.
You know, I don't know. I don't think that's going to happen. And that's something, Chris, that I thought was so interesting that's really on display in this episode is the megalomania of Dekkad. The fact that he thinks and like that there's even an inkling in his brain that somehow him and Kira might get freaky one day. Like, you have to be crazy to think that. She hates you with every fiber of her being.
But he doesn't spend enough time with her. You can tell he's really hurt that they don't spend enough time together. They don't get to talk about things other than station operations.
Oh, God, it's just so creepy, especially when you learn that, you know, he also had her mother as well. And so this guy is just a sicko in every
But I wonder if that's part of why he thinks. Like, he thinks that he somehow has some control over the Kira family.
Maybe. I just think that he is delusional enough to believe that she could, as he always wants, for the Bajoran people to see just how great he was, you know? And one day she's going to come around and she's gonna want to wear that fancy dress to dinner with me, and I'm gonna take her back to my quarters, and then bow, chicka,
wow, fade to black.
I mean, that it really is. You know, when people talk about the fact that, you know, Dekkad wasn't megalomaniac or, you know, wasn't crazy or anything or evil, I think it is just fully on display in this episode how crazy and just kind of how evil he is. You know, he has no idea of any kind of the morality of the situations that he's dealing with. He's in his own little world of how he feels about things and kind of making things up in his mind. The fact that him and Kira are going to be copacetic one day, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. And his arrogance is on display as well.
Yeah.
And his feelings about the Dominion. I think Mark Lamo did a great job just delivering the line early on in the episode where he says, it's a great day for Cardassia and the Dominion.
Yeah.
It's just sort of brushed off. And, you know exactly his position. I mean, he may have sold Cardassia to the Dominion, as Kira says, but in his mind, he's got the whole plan worked out, and it's only for the glory of Cardassia. He's very confident that he's somehow going to be able to throw the Dominion off at some point.
Well, yeah, and that is a great conversation that they do have about the whole thing of him admitting that, yes, he had sold out his people to the Dominion, and it's only because he's, in his mind, using the Dominion gain prominence, whereas the Dominion is using Cardassia as a foothold in the Alpha Quadrant. And, you know, with the power of the Dominion and the ruthlessness of the Dominion, obviously we know who's being used here. And it's not Dukat, you know, using the Dominion. It's definitely the other way around.
So there's another scene early on where Dukat and Damar and Kira and Wayoon are talking, and you can tell that it's a very uneasy alliance that they have, because the Dominion has their non-aggression treaty with Bajor, and I think from Wayoon's perspective, as long as they can have Bajor, they're going to leave the Bajoran people alone. I'm sure they're going to demand some, you know, whatever happens in the Gamma Quadrant, whatever, you know, the little seeds that we saw placed from season two onward about how the different worlds of the Dominion fit into that governance by the Founders. But Wayoon and the Dominion, they're not going to put troops on Bajor. I don't get that feeling. They're not going to try to subjugate the Bajoran people in the way that the Cardassians did during the occupation. But Cardassia is part of the Dominion, and Bajor is not part of the Dominion. They just have this non-aggression treaty the way the Romulans do as well. And you can tell that this isn't going to work out, because the Cardassians see this as an opportunity to retake Bajor. So within the leadership, they are already at odds. Dukat and Wayoon are already at odds with one another. And Bajor and Kira don't want to have anything to do with the situation either. So it's a very, very uneasy alliance that they've put into place here.
Well, and it's so interesting because in some ways I think that the Dominion has the feeling that if we can show how we treat Bajor to the rest of the Alpha Quadrant,
yeah,
maybe there is a possibility that we can have the same kind of governance of the Alpha Quadrant as we do the Gamma Quadrant, which, you know, everybody talks in hushed tones in the Gamma Quadrant about the Dominion, but we really don't know enough about their rule to know exactly how bad it is. It does seem like if you're out of line, we hear they send in the Jem'Hadar and, you know, Kobayashi Maru, it's over.
Well, I mean, you've got Hippocratic Oath, yeah, where they actually put a disease on,
yeah,
the planet,
yeah,
because they were out of line.
So I think they're trying to put their best foot forward in the Alpha Quadrant and portray themselves as being a lot more benevolent than they are. And obviously Kira's not buying that. The Bajorans aren't buying it. They've had this before with the Cardassians, obviously. And so, yeah, I think this is something that you see in the show, that the Cardassians hate the Bajorans, and the Bajorans also hate the Dominion. The Cardassians hate the Dominion. You know, everybody kind of hates each other. The Dominion doesn't really hate anybody. It just, they're just looking to, you know, take over,
yeah,
as soon as possible.
Expand their footprint.
Yeah, yeah. So there's just no way this is going to end well for anyone.
I would say about the Dominion, though, that I guess their ultimate goal is to subjugate any and all solids as a way of protecting themselves. That's the view that the Founders have. I think that's why they try to subjugate people, which is different from, say, the Cardassians or even humans historically, or Klingons, who actually want to conquer territory to kind of add to their empire. It's not necessarily a protective thing.
Yeah. I don't know. Definitely it's a protection thing, but I also think at the same time, the Dominion's not above conquering. I think they just conquer for a different reason than, say, like Klingons or humans almost. But, you know, for the Klingons, it's the to prove their greatness over other races. And for human beings, well, the Federation doesn't conquer at this point. You know, they just...
Not at this point, yeah, but humans historically.
Yeah, we have. But, you know, now that humans are part of the society of the Federation, it is definitely different. So, yeah, it's just such an interesting thing to see. I don't know how the Dominion thinks that this is going to work. But I also don't think the Dominion planned on there being a massive minefield in the way of constant reinforcements from the Gamma Quadrant, which has really put a crimp in their plans.
I don't think they planned on the type of resistance that they've gotten from the Federation and the Alpha Beta powers. You'd get this impression, like if you look at Voyager, in the Delta Quadrant, it seems that almost all the races that we encounter in the Delta Quadrant, apart from the Borg, are technologically much less advanced than the Federation or the Klingons or the Romulans or the Cardassians, the powers that we have in the Alpha and the Beta Quadrant. So the Gamma Quadrant could be similar, where there aren't so many powerful civilizations or alliances in the Gamma Quadrant, and it's easier for the Dominion to control all of these worlds. So when they came into the Alpha Quadrant, they were perhaps anticipating a similar situation, and there's going to be some skirmish, and they're going to have to destroy ships and kill some people, but it's not going to be anything that they can't control easily. And instead, they found these very strong powers who were individually strong, who then came together and formed a very strong resistance and have the technological prowess to do something like the self-replicating cloaked minefield.
Well, and the Dominion itself has existed for several millennia.
Yeah.
You know, and so they, in their area of the galaxy, you know, they've been in control for a very long time, whereas in this part of the galaxy, that kind of control hasn't happened for one species. And so it is quite different from what they know and what they've experienced in their own part of the galaxy. And so I think that's the other reason they are so fearful of these Alpha Quadrant powers, because, you know, the Alpha Quadrant has spent its whole existence not being conquered by, you know, other people. You know, the Federation became the main power in the quadrant, and it's a friendly cooperation. And so that goes against everything that the founders understand, which is dominion.
Right. Well, also talking about weariness and uneasy feelings on the station, Odo and Kira have a lot of very hush-hush conversations. And knowing the path that Odo is going to go down in this arc, Kira urges him to use his power over Weyoun to get things that he wants and to get things that they need. And then Weyoun asks him to join the governing council of the station. What do you think about the mood of Odo, what he says to Kira, and then this decision to join the governing council, and where that leads Odo as a character? Because, I mean, we've talked about Odo on the show a lot, how he kind of adapts to the situation and he goes along. You know, he worked for the Cardassians, he kind of goes along, and he's adapting to this new situation right now.
Well, it's an interesting thing because it's in some way Kira's fault, because she puts him in this position and kind of pushes him into it. And then, of course, once he joins, she almost rethinks what she had said. And of course, then we know where it goes, you know, not Odo really being tempted by really kind of like a Satan-type character, you know, the eat the apple. And you're speaking
of the female changeling.
Yes, the female changeling, you know, so it really takes him away from where he's supposed to be and who he's supposed to be. So that's a really interesting thing. But I think what's interesting is Odo's idea of, okay, if I'm on the inside, I can learn the information that we haven't been able to get anywhere. Right. And what I did love in this episode, and I thought was great, was Odo using that power of being a quote-unquote god to the Vorta to get what he wanted. And there was no question, you know, like, Weyoun was going to have no question of Odo's request. It was going to be done, you know, so right. Let it be written, so let it be done, basically.
He could have been like, and I want 5 Dabo girls stationed in my office at all times. I see
exactly.
No problem with that.
Yeah. he could have had Quark thrown off the station, finally. I mean, he could have had anything he wanted, because to Weyoun, the god is finally asking for a request from him, and that's what he has been created to do, is to serve that person. And so I really liked Odo embracing that for the good, you know. And I think it really becomes a thing of the very tropey Spider-Man thing of with great power comes great responsibility. And Odo doesn't really know how to handle that, and then ends up mishandling it very badly because of his longings for, you know, home and all of that, which are completely understandable. And yet at the same time, Odo, come on, bro. I mean, there's a time and a place to join with another changeling and to do that, but it's not here and now. What I think is most interesting about the storyline, obviously, is for the female changeling, it doesn't have anything to do with keeping Odo occupied or trying to win the war or anything like that to her. Odo is the most important thing, so...
Yeah,
we'll talk about that later on. But
yeah, we're getting ahead of ourselves in the story here a little bit, because this stuff comes later on. But what Odo decides to do in this episode sets him down that path. What I find interesting about Odo here, too, is just trying to gauge where his allegiance lies. Is it with the Federation? Is it with Kira and Sisko and his crewmates on DS9 over the past 5 years? Is it with the Dominion? Not so much in the sense that he supports them conquering other worlds, but as you were just describing, his longing for home, those are his people. Or is his allegiance kind of up for grabs, depending on who's in control of the station at the time? You know, is it possible that there's a path that could lead to him working together with Dukat again to govern the station and to secure the station, that's at odds with both the Federation and the Dominion? But I get the feeling when he's sitting there with Kira that at this point his allegiance is still to her and to Sisko and to the crew. But it feels weak, like you don't know for sure, especially given the character, where it's going to go.
See, I might disagree, because I feel like his full allegiance is to Kira. Especially the conversation that they're having there at the bar, you know, the fact that, you know, she says the only time that she can smile is with him, and that really lights Odo up.
Yeah, I agree on that. Yeah.
I think his full allegiance is with her. He just feels frustrated because he can't do anything.
Yeah. But the station has been lost by the Federation, and Kira's not the Federation. So he can have an allegiance to her without having allegiance to the former governing body of the station with the Federation.
That's true. But I think, just like Quark, Odo would much rather be under Federation rule than, you know, Dominion rule.
Well, I think Quark would much rather be under Kira, Matthew.
I wasn't going to go there, but you're right. Who wouldn't? But I'm not going to lie. Who wouldn't? But I think that Odo would much rather see the station in the hands of the Federation, and partly because, again, it does harken back to Kira and Bajor, which Kira is a part of, and so it does all get wrapped up in his feelings for Kira, which is why what happens is such a big thing for them. You know, it's more about betraying her and their friends than it is about betraying the Federation. And that's what makes this whole storyline really different than anything we've ever seen in Star Trek before, because it's not just about fighting for the Federation. It's these group of people that aren't part of the Federation yet, but yet they're still our friends and allies. So it makes for a much more well-rounded show of why do we fight? Well, lots of people fight for different reasons in wars, but we all come at it, you know, a common cause against a common enemy. We just all get there sometimes for different reasons. So I think that's a really cool thing that they're just kind of showing throughout this whole series, and especially in this this beginning episode of this new season.
You know, why do we fight? Reminds me of the conversation that Sisko had with his dad in this episode, where his dad says, "You always tell me space is so big, and it's this new frontier, and you would think that with so much space, there would be room for everyone to live their lives and get along and not bother each other." And Sisko says, "That's just not how it works."
Well, yeah, that is something strange that we do see in Star Trek. I mean, the galaxies are vast, and yet we're all still fighting over the same planets, even though there's plenty of new ones out there to explore.
I don't think that's necessarily out of line with reality, though, because when you hear scientists talk about, you know, like SETI scientists talk about searching for aliens, and then others warn that we need to be careful. Like right now, actually, SETI is proposing that we start actively broadcasting, announcing that we're here instead of just trying to pick up signals, because we've had no luck picking up signals. And the idea is that if we broadcast, maybe we'll wake someone up and then they know we're here. And there's some warning that, well, this may not be a very good idea. And the flip side of that argument is, well, there's nothing to worry about because they'll be very, very advanced and there's no reason why they're going to want to hurt us. You know, we're far away. But I think in the reality, like, no matter how big space is, if we had the technology like we have in Star Trek to travel quickly to all these other worlds faster than the speed of light, I think it's like just human nature, or the nature of other life forms that may be similar to us thinking in the way we do, that we're just always going to be in conflict. You're always going to want to have whatever it is on the other side of the fence.
Yeah, I mean, the rationale that just because they're advanced means that they're friendly is kind of dumb.
Yeah, that's,
I mean,
not,
how would
very
you know? I mean, have
argument.
You never seen sci-fi at all? I mean, it's like in Galaxy Quest where guys like, "Do you guys ever watch the show?"
Right.
You know? I don't. Yeah, that doesn't make any sense to me, that rationale that, oh, well, they'll just be advanced. It will be fine.
But apart from that, I mean, I don't think that the distance is actually something that would prevent this from happening. I think once we have the technology where we can close that gap, then the same things that happen here on Earth are going to happen on a galactic scale. It's just the way of nature. Yeah. It's the way of existence, unfortunately. Yeah.
It is. I think if there was a way to travel at high warp and to be able to reach those places, you know, within a few days or a couple of weeks, it would make it much different than it is today. Now, whether that ever happens ever in all of human history, I don't know. Because breaking the warp barrier does seem to almost be impossible without some sort of wormhole type technology or something like that. Really, some space bending technology to kind of really cheat going that fast without, you know, the whole mass principle. So anyway, that's about as much as I know about, you know, actual physics and space travel. So, you know, turning back to the episode, and because we really took an unexpected turn there, Chris, and I didn't think we were going to go that far.
Well, we did, but it's based on the conversation between Ben and
Scott. So. But Sisko, kind of, his career takes an unexpected turn in this, in that, you know, Admiral Ross tells him, this is going to be your office, and you're going to be working here for some time. In fact, the Defiant isn't under your command anymore. I'm sending you on this mission, but when you get back, this is where you're going to be. And what an interesting thing to take, you know, the captain, not only off his station, but off his ship, and put him in a leadership role with basically running the war. I mean, he's like the liaison to Eisenhower planning D-Day. I mean, that's who Ross is Eisenhower, basically. And yeah. He's working with him planning these missions. What an unexpected place to put Sisko, and what a statement to make about your captain,
to say this guy is the guy who's going to lead us to victory, basically.
Well, Sisko is one person who you definitely cannot see being happy with the desk job during the war. I mean, he says earlier in the episode that if he has anything to do with it, they'll be going right back to the front lines. But he's a very hands-on leader. He wants to be in the fight, and they're going to go stick him at a desk somewhere. Now, as you say, it could be that Ross believes that Sisko is the greatest strategist that they have and that he's the person that they need to be there planning things and directing the war so that they can win, that he can do more for them there at that desk than he can do on the Defiant on the front lines. It could also just be wanting to protect a captain, although I don't think that's the case, because if you're Starfleet, you can't start deciding that you're going to protect all of your most valuable officers, all the captains. You need them out there. You need their experience.
Unless they're Picard and you just send them to the Briar Patch and stuff like that.
You know, just let them go chase some comets, whatever.
Yeah.
While something else is going on. It is true, right? Yeah. Sending the Enterprise to the Briar Patch during the Dominion War. All right. Well,
what I love about this whole path with Sisko is that there's something about him that we're going to learn, and it's a really neat character trait of the fact that he has apparently a great strategic mind.
Yeah.
You know, to be able to think big picture, you know, it's one thing to be a good captain and kind of be great to ship-to-ship combat, that kind of stuff, and think on that term. But obviously Khan gets dinged by Kirk saying he's two-dimensional in his thinking.
Right.
Well, apparently Sisko is the greatest three-dimensional thinker there is, because he's helping plan the multi-pronged attacks of this war in three-dimensional space.
So are you saying that you want to see a movie where it's Sisko versus Kirk?
Ooh, that'd be really cool. Sisko versus Kirk. Mainly because they could both punch each other.
Yeah.
Because they're that kind of people. I could really see that working. I think that would be really, really interesting showdown.
We've seen them work together in the comics.
That is true. And we've also seen them meet each other in Trials and Tribulations. So
that's right.
It would be kind of cool to see them go head to head for some reason in some sort of alternate universe comic thing. I don't know. That'd be pretty cool.
All right. But yeah, so this is where we get into the idea that Sisko is a great strategist. And then you feel like it was, I guess you would say it was just a lucky chance that the Federation put one of their greatest strategists on the station, on Deep Space Nine, right at what would become the front lines of this war. And they did it when he was a commander and they had no idea what they were doing.
You know, sometimes you just catch a lucky break. You know, I do think that maybe, you know, as all good organizations, they saw something in Sisko. That's why they assigned him the station.
Yeah.
But as we all know, it's really fate. It's the prophets behind
right.
this all, because Sisko is of Bajor. He must be on that station. He must be the person who will be there at that time. So in the end...
So, but of course, Ross doesn't know that. I mean,
that's
Starfleet true. Is uncomfortable with the idea of Ben being a religious icon of the Bajorans. But another aspect of the story, so Ross sends them on this mission in this Jem'Hadar fighter to go and destroy the Ketracel White facility. Knowing what you just said, that it's fate, it's the prophets guiding Sisko, did that lessen in any way for you the danger at the end of the episode when they could have been killed, they weren't, but now they're crippled and they're behind enemy lines in a damaged enemy ship with no warp drive? But you know that the prophets need to get Sisko back there. So ultimately, nothing can ever happen to Sisko. Now, this is, of course, all looking back with what we know. So at this point in the story, how does that work for you?
I don't think I ever thought about that part until, obviously, you know, getting to the end and where they had gone, and then realizing, yeah. oh my gosh, this really is this kind of big, huge twist of fate by the prophets. And so
you have to take this story as if you're watching it for the first time when it first mm-hmm. aired.
Yep. When it first aired, I never would have thought about that.
No one knows yet.
But I didn't think they were going to kill off my captain or, you know, anything like that on the show. I didn't think they were going to be that bold. But yeah, they do. I mean, again, this does take some chances. You know, you're left with this huge cliffhanger at the end of the season. They took our station away, and now they've taken our ship away, and now we're gonna die. We're 17 years from home. It's like Dumb and Dumber. We got no food. We got no job. Our pets' heads are falling off. I mean, could it get any worse?
It could. It could be Dumb and Dumberer.
Yeah, oh, that's true. Oh, or Dumb and Dumber 2 could be way worse.
With a T-O, so, yes.
Anyway, so yeah, I think that it's just a crazy thing. I mean, this mission to destroy the Ketracel White is a massive thing. You know, they are involved in creating a minefield that will keep the Dominion from coming in at the end of the season. And at the beginning of the season, they are, you know, paramount in carrying out an attack on a Ketracel White factory that is the main Ketracel White factory for the entire Alpha Quadrant that could significantly alter this war for the better for the Federation and the Allies if they can make this happen. So it is very cool and obviously small universe-y for the Deep Space Nine crew to be the ones that would do this. But they also have the most
But they have the most experience
with the Jem'Hadar ships, right. And they're the ones who stole that ship. And
Do you think at the Ketracel White factory, do you think that the little canisters of Ketracel White have labels on them that says, like, this was processed on machines that also process nuts and dairy and so forth?
Do not confuse with soy milk.
Right.
Possibly.
You have some Jem'Hadar with an allergy, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. No. You can't give Jimmy the same Ketracel White as me. He's allergic to nuts. If he even breathes, you know, in the dust of a nut, you know, he just blows up like my Aunt Roberta. It'd be really funny to hear a Jem'Hadar say.
You're just picturing a Jem'Hadar saying that.
Funny when you see the Jem'Hadar in this episode and, you know, they're just sitting there quirked and he's so frustrated because they don't do anything and they're taking up space in his bar, not spending any money.
Go play some Dabo or do something. Yeah. Go to the holosuite.
Go do anything other than just sit there.
Wouldn't you think the Jem'Hadar would love a holosuite program where, like, it's a lagoon and a waterfall, but it's all Ketracel White? They're swimming in it. It's gushing over the mountaintop.
It just seems you'd walk in and you'd be like, why are they swimming in a cereal bowl of milk?
Okay, I'm going to go beyond the series for a minute, just thinking about books for a minute, because there are two things here. Them sitting at Quark's, the Jem'Hadar there, made me watching it now after, of course, finishing the series and reading books, thinking about Tyranitar, the Jem'Hadar ambassador, for lack of a better word, that Odo sends to the station. And also Garak going on the mission to the Ketracel White facility, knowing where Garak winds up leading Cardassia later on, way down the road. What do you think when you watch it now? Like, when you think about how the characters develop and you see these moments, particularly with Garak?
It is really, I don't know, it's really interesting to see how they create these characters that can have such life. You know, that you can create life even after the series. You know, Ira on the Trekland speaker that Larry Nemechek did, he even talks about that somebody is going to write books and they're going to continue this on, but I can't even think about this at this point, you know. So the Jem'Hadar, you know, we have seen abnormal Jem'Hadar before on the series. So they've already kind of set that up of what it would be like to have a Jem'Hadar who isn't just completely bloodthirsty and just the following orders type of trying to do something new with Garrick, you know, seeing his whole growth throughout the series and in the very few episodes that he's in, honestly, throughout the run. It's great that you could actually, by the end of the series, see him being somebody maybe one day who, you know, runs Cardassia. And as Una McCormick said in our latest interview, you know, she feels like she's putting Garrick through penance now, having to deal with democracy and, and, you know, all these committees and such. So I just I think what it's a testament to just the creators of the show and the characters that they made that you automatically could create more stories for as the series ended. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. With Garrick, and even staying in show, the role that we see Garrick play towards the end of season 7, seeing him go on this mission, seeing him offer to wear the Google Glass so that they can see outside the ship, because it's giving Sisko such bad headaches. Him just stepping up and taking that role at this point to lead them into Cardassian space and to fight the Dominion. It's an interesting seed being planted. He's just such an interesting character. And with the Jem'Hadar, you mentioned, you know, Jem'Hadar who aren't bloodthirsty. One reason that this reminded me of Tyranitar is the fact that you have these Jem'Hadar mingling with other people on the station and not just killing them. You know, they're acting kind of like normal aliens. In fact, they're much better behaved than Nausicaans, if you had Nausicaans in the bar. And the one other thing that we need to talk about today relates to them walking around like that, where you have Wayoon walking down the promenade and he has two Jem'Hadar with him, and then Jake Sisko comes up. And the way that, and of course it's because Wayoon is there and the Jem'Hadar have to obey the Vorta, but just watching those Jem'Hadar observe Jake in this conversation with Wayoon and being pretty calm about it, I would say, was interesting, and that reminded me of Tyranitar.
Yeah, I think it's really neat because just the idea of some beings like the Jem'Hadar and what will happen after the Dominion War, you know, what will they become and how will they change and all that? It's a really interesting question to just think about, you know, even if you don't end up reading the books or whatever, just kind of thinking, okay, how would the Dominion change this race of people that they have created and bred for only one thing, and that is, you know, to kill others? What do you do with a race like that? You know, it reminds me of the song in White Christmas. What do you do with a general when he's done being a general? You know, what do you do with a warrior when there's no need for a warrior?
Ask a Klingon.
That's true.
They might have an answer for that. So about Jake, that's the last topic to talk about here in this episode. They're really taking Jake down his own path now. And going back to the conversation that Ben had with his dad's very upset that you left my grandson on a station with a bloodthirsty enemy. But, you know, Jake is his own man now. He's his own, he makes his own decisions, as Sisko says. And here he is trying to get an interview with Wayoon. And I think there is a bit of maybe Federation naivety there. When Jake finds out that Wayoon has not been broadcasting his stories, and Jake says, "What about freedom of the press?" And Wayoon says, "Don't tell me you're that naive." But what do you think about the growth of Jake here with the storyline?
Well, I think it's a really great storyline, personally. You know, this is the storyline that I think is the one that will, you know, transform this character, and it's going to give him a great relationship with Kira and the rest of this crew in a way that he hasn't had before, that's still left on the station. And I think it was also a really neat thing to see them kind of transition. Okay, this is not a boy. This is a man now, and we're gonna have him make a very male, naive decision, and yet the same kind of decision that, you know, a young man might make, and have to learn from that mistake and learn about the ways of the universe the hard way. I think it's just a really nice, cool storyline, and you know, he's in a big mess, you know, because he's definitely not safe. And I say that just because on the Cardassian side, I think on the Dominion side, there's no reason for them to want to harm Jake whatsoever.
Right. Yeah.
That would only be bad news for them.
But
the Cardassians really could care less. So, you know, any mistake could happen while Jake's on the station.
Well, in fact, if Dukat wanted to get back at Sisko, he's got his sign right there on the station that he could harm, he could use him as a, you know, basically a hostage situation, in fact. So I like, and I think I said this at the end of our first part discussion. Mm-hmm. It's been, I don't know, 6 weeks since we recorded that, so I don't remember for sure. Now, if you're listening to these straight through, you might say, you just said that, Chris. But the growth of the relationship between Sisko and Jake from emissary, where he's the boy fishing on the bridge and being unhappy about this new home, and then you see him grow up on the show and you see the father-son relationship, and then hear Sisko explaining, he's making his own decisions now. You know, I have to let go. I have to let him make those decisions. Really shows the not only the character growth, but the passage of time on the show as well. It just feels like this show feels so much more real, right? Like these are real lives of real people versus what we've gotten in other Star Trek, especially leading up to this point.
Yeah, and it's one of the hallmarks, I think, of this show is treating these characters like real human beings, you know, real beings that have real lives, real consequences for their actions that keep playing out, you know, continually throughout the series. So it's a really nice change from the majority of Trek that we had gotten before.
Absolutely. So when we end the episode, we see Sisko and his crew in the Jem'Hadar fighter trying to make their way back home. And it's a nice scene again, because if you go into this thinking that they're going to go back and they're going to retake the station, and then the episode ends with them in really dire straits. And my thought was, by the time they ever get back, the war will be over, long over. And so they went on this mission to destroy this facility, which could make an enormous difference in the war, but they'll never know. And when they finally get back, it'll all be in the history books for them. And that's where we leave it. And so next time, when we continue our series on the Dominion invasion arc, we will be talking about Rocks and Shoals, which I remember always thinking was a very unique episode as a Star Trek episode when I saw it for the first time.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about that one, because I think there's a lot that's really interesting and pretty big and bold for them to be doing on TV, mainly just because most of it's outside.
That's one thing that I thought was so unique about it. We don't see this kind of outdoors on location type thing so much on Star Trek.
Yeah, it really doesn't happen, but I feel like if we keep talking about it, Chris, we are just going to transition to Rocks and Shoals.
We are. We're going to go straight into it right now, and maybe some people would like that, but you'll have to wait another month for us to get back to the next part of this series, because we'll have some other orbs in between, as we always do. Well, Matthew, again, we could talk about this forever, but we also talk about other things on the network. So here's a quick look at some of those things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
This episode isn't very good, but...
Are we just going to pin all of our choices?
You pretty much have to. But the thing about this episode, which we talked about a couple weeks ago, I think, is it's a crazy idea.
Earl Grey.
Picard, can you construct a rudimentary lathe?
Go for its weak spot. It's an energy being. It doesn't have a vulnerable spot. Get off the line, the Forge.
The Orb.
Or we could just blame it on Janeway somehow, you know, that she scared the Borg into the Gamma Quadrant because they were tired of dealing with her in the Delta Quadrant. I don't know.
To the journey!
Because this is the dangers, by the way, kids, of having babies in the 24th century. Because if Kathy's first word was coffee and she was standing next to the replicator, the next thing you know, you have a hyped up 2-year-old.
The Ready Room.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, you've got your lucky shirt when you're watching a football game and your team won when you were wearing it. So now you have to wear it every time. That's also the Enterprise insignia. That's the insignia of the only ship whose crew didn't die.
Yeah.
So
just wear
course.
It on the right color shirt. That's all.
That's right.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
And then he turns to her and he says, who is that man that I was just hugging? And she says, that was William Shatner. And he's like, who?
Literary Treks.
Well, yeah, I'm really a fan of a lot of, you know, different kinds of, you know, naval fiction. You know, C.S. Forrester, Horatio Hornblower, those novels.
So good.
Yeah, you know, Patrick O'Brien, you know, the Master and Commander books. You know, these are all things which sort of put me into the right mindset.
The 602 Club.
So when we come kind of to the story here, and especially off of doing Literary Treks where we talk about Michael Piller's book Fade In, kind of got behind the scenes of Insurrection and really seeing how that story changed. To me, it really just exemplified the importance of story in a movie.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find them everywhere you get your podcasts, on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, BlackBerry. You can go to our website and stream from the show page or download the MP3 file or grab the RSS link. While you're in iTunes or on Stitcher, please take a moment and leave us a star rating and a written review. We love to hear what you think about the show, but also, those help us rise up in the search results. Also, subscriptions. If you're in iTunes and you're streaming the show, hit that subscribe button. You'll get the latest episode as soon as we publish it, and that also helps us rise up in the search results, and it just makes it easier for other Deep Space Nine fans to find the Orb as they're looking for podcasts. Matthew, we also need to thank our associate producers here on The Orb. We have so many people supporting the show and helping us bring Deep Space Nine discussion to everyone out there every week. And we'd like to thank Norman Lau, Ruth Ward, Lisa Stevens, Will Wynn, and Renee Roberts, all associate producers here on The Orb. And I'd also like to thank Richard Marquez, our production manager, who helps get the shows out to everyone. All the shows on the network, actually. I think this is something that a lot of listeners don't know, is that Richard is working behind the scenes every single day to do the final publishing steps and make sure the shows get out to everyone. So thanks, Norm, Ruth, Lisa, Will, Renee, and Richard for all of your hard work and all of your support in keeping the shows coming to everyone. Now, Matthew, if people want to share their thoughts on A Time to Stand with us, where's the best place for them to do that?
Well, Chris, you can do that by contacting us on trek.fm/contact. But if you really want to get that in-depth conversation, I think the best way to do that is with the Babel Conference. That's our listeners-only discussion group there on Facebook. And I can't tell you how much fun I've had with the conversations there with everyone. And so if you'd like to join, just search the Babel Conference there on Facebook or go to discussion on the menu bar on our website here on Trek FM. And just click join and we will let you into the group and you can jump into all the discussions that we've been having there throughout all our shows. And just, man, we have fun conversations, in-depth conversations. It's kind of like being at a Star Trek convention every single day.
Actually, it is. I hadn't thought about that, but it is a lot like that, except we don't have long lines to stand in.
That is true, which is great because, oh my gosh, have you... just don't enjoy standing in lines when I'm wanting to meet my, you know, favorite Star Trek star. And now if we could only get some Star Trek stars to join the Fable Conference. That'd be great.
We do have a lot of creators who chime in, though. You know, Doug
that
Drexler.
That is true.
If you talk about the Enterprise NX-01, Doug Drexler will reply to your thread.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had great discussions with Doug on there. Of course, Larry's there. Many other people pop in all the time. So come join us over there. And again, just type B-A-B-E-L into the search field on Facebook, and that's enough, and it'll pop right up, and you'll see it, and you can just click straight on through there. So Matthew, besides the Babel Conference, if people want to talk to you, maybe, you know, catch you when you're not planning the next great strategic move for the Federation and the war, where should they go?
Well, people can find me on Literary Treks with Dan, where we talk about the books and comics of Star Trek. And they can also find me on the 602 Club, where we talk about all things geeky. I just choose a great new topic each week and have a lot of fun. Talked about all sorts of things from Indiana Jones with John Champion and Norman Lau to something like the Galaxy Quest movie or some of the new geek TV shows. I mean, just talking about all sorts of stuff. So we have a great time over there. And then, of course, I'm on Twitter at MattRushing02. And then also have my own personal website at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. And Chris, where can everybody find you online these days?
Well, finding me online these days is a little bit touch and go with my schedule. I'm still trying to settle in and figure out how to, you know, keep up with everything in social media, but I do hang out in the Babel Conference. I do keep an eye on that as much as I can. So you can find me there, and you can also find me on Twitter. My username is C Brian Jones, the letter C and Brian with a Y. And then elsewhere on the network, of course, you can find me on the Ready Room, where I'm joined sometimes by you, Matthew, just like today. We recorded a new Ready Room right before this orb. And you can also find me doing Hyperchannel, our short Star Trek news show, a day or two a week. And tune into those if you want to find out more about my thoughts on the world of Star Trek. One more thing we'd like to tell you about before we go today is how you can support the show and support the network. We're a listener-supported network, and that means we need your help to keep Star Trek Talk coming to you every week with the Orb, and every day of the week, in fact, with all of our shows. And the way you can help us out is to go over to patreon.com/trekfm. That's a way for you to support us on a month-to-month basis. You can set any amount that you would like, from $1 onward. Every little bit helps us keep the shows coming, because we have a lot of costs associated with production, with hosting, with distribution. And it's thanks to everyone who supports us through Patreon that we're able to keep bringing shows to you. So go check those out over there, patreon.com/trekfm, and we really thank you for any support that you can give us.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time as we gaze into the orb.